Well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, friends, colleagues, to the beginning of this this conference. Rather a short conference, but a very concentrated one, I hope. I've always rather liked the idea of organising a small conference in which people would really want to talk about the same things, and I hope that that's what we've got. Nearly everyone's here too, and I hope everyone will be eventually coming. But there are a couple of unfortunate exceptions. One is that Gary Sheffield, who is going to chair the first session, who, as you know, is one of the leading authorities on the British Army in the First World War, emailed me late last night to say that he was ill, and again this morning to say he was still ill and he couldn't come. So I'm afraid I'm going to have to stand in for him very inadequately as chairman of this first session. Another loss is that Robert Foley, who was going to come and reply to Remy Pott's paper on 1940, can't come because of an illness, a serious illness in his family. So I'm afraid I have to stand in for him too. So I apologise for that in advance. But at least I can introduce the speakers of our first session. Perhaps I could say I've tried to arrange things so that we have plenty of time for discussion. And as long as we keep reasonably to our times, then I think there'll be time for everyone to say what they want to say. So our speakers are going to summarise their papers for about 20 minutes, and then there'll be a response for 10, and then a panel discussion, and then we shall have a general discussion right at the end of the session. I hope that seems acceptable. I ought to say before we start, there are a few very important, trivial though important matters. First of all, here on the table are expenses forms. Those of you who need to claim expenses, I'd be glad if you would fill in one of them and let me have it. It's self-explanatory when conveniently possible. I've been wondering about people who are travelling from France. I thought the easiest might be actually to reimburse you in cash, if that's okay. If you don't mind having sterling rather than euros. there are also copies of the programme here if anyone needs one. Please pick one up later. There's also a flyer for a new book of Rémy Pott, Chronologie commentée de la Première Guerre mondiale. And there's also a notice of a series of lectures that Jay Winter is going to be giving. Imagining war in the 20th century and after. So please do take one of these if you're interested. We're also going to have a little display of books. Our local bookshop, Heffers, insisted on doing a display of books tomorrow. So around about lunchtime, various of our books, I hope, will be on display. But now, 2 minutes late, we're going to... David, yes.
This is a heretical comment, Robert. Would it be possible just for people to introduce themselves at
yes.
this point?
Oh, absolutely.
So we can identify.
Yes, thank you. In fact, I was going to suggest that, and I'd forgotten. And you'll see this is a sort of no-frills conference in some ways. And what I haven't done, I couldn't bring myself to do it, was to make a lot of name badges. So perhaps when you first speak, you could just say who you are, and then we'll remember thereafter.
If anyone is running around the room.
Sorry?
Wouldn't think of running around the room for everyone to say what he or she is.
Oh, we could do that, couldn't we? Shall we all... Well, let's do that and also say who we are when we first speak, and then we'll have heard everyone twice and we may have some. But I'll introduce the speakers first, who are John Keeger. And many of you know each other, so forgive the superfluous detail, but John Keeger is Professor of International History at the University of Salford, author of the pioneering and standard work, France and the Origins of the First World War, and of other works on French foreign policy and a great many other things besides. And he's going to talk about 1914. Oh, hello, Julia. Julian Jackson. William Philpott, Bill Philpott on the front row, who is... newly appointed or about to be appointed professor of the history of war, is it still?
History of warfare.
King's College London, author most recently of, I think it's your most recent book, Bloody Victory, The Sacrifice on the Somme and the Making of the 20th Century. And Elizabeth Greenhouse, also on the front row, research fellow at the School of Humanities and Social Sciences, University of New South Wales, at the Australian Defence Academy. author of Victory Through Coalition, Britain and France During the First World War. Bill, of course, one of the leading authorities on the First World War, and particularly the British Army. Elizabeth on the coalition coalition warfare, of course, and Elizabeth too. I suppose we've got two of the leading, if not the leading, or perhaps the leading authorities on this particular subject. And those who are going to reply to their papers are Professor Christopher Clark, Professor of Modern European History here in Cambridge, who is there, who is the author, among many other things, of Iron Kingdom, his much acclaimed and lauded history of Prussia. Professor Stéphane Audouin-Rousseau, who is Professor and Director of Studies at the École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales, author of many works on the First World War, including 1914-1918, Understanding the Great War, which he wrote with Annette Becker, who's also here, I'm glad to say, and also both of them co-founders of the Mémorial à Péronne. And I was going to say Gary Sheffield, but as I said, he's not here, but he did actually send his response, so I shall sort of be reading what Gary would have said had he been here. And I think for the time being that's quite enough from me, so I'd like to hand over to John Keeger, who will now give us his paper.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Bob. Well, I'll get straight into this. On the 3rd of August 1914, Germany declared war on France. The following day, Britain declared war on Germany. But it was only on the following 5th of September that by the Treaty of London, France and the British Empire formally became allies, along with the Russian Empire. The political and military alliance that France had sought, arguably for the previous decade, became reality. But why did Britain become France's ally effectively on the 4th of August 1914? And why had France sought a British alliance? How have the French and British remembered this 10-year process, and what have they forgotten about it? To a large extent, the French have remembered their 1914-18 war union with Britain as the natural outcome, or even the extension of, the 1904 Entente Cordiale. And that period from 1904 to 1914, they have also viewed, generally anyway, through rather rose-tinted spectacles. But in so doing, they have erased, or at least underplayed, the anguished position of the British government in agreeing to discuss the possibility of eventual joint military and naval deployments with France in the event of war with Germany, and overlooked the frequent disappointment with Britain that verged on a total break in 1914. In truth, the 10-year genesis of the eventual British commitment to France was marked by controversy, prejudice, and cross-cultural misunderstandings on both sides of the Channel. The low point came on the 2nd of August 1914, when the French ambassador in London, Paul Cambon, unable to secure the commitment from the British Foreign Secretary that Britain would come to France's aid if attacked by Germany, which he believed existed, and which Sir Edward Grey was adamant did not, asked whether the word honour should not be struck out of the English vocabulary. Both states, though, at the time, had different interpretations of the same narrative. Why was that so? Still today, I think historians argue about the nature and the extent of the British commitment to France prior to 1914. But in the end, the differing perceptions of that commitment in London and Paris lie with cultural crossed wires rather than actual degrees of commitment. And how did that misunderstanding of each other's policies, strategies, and perceptions come about? Why were Britain and France engaged in what seemed like a dialogue of the deaf during the previous decade? The British commitment to France prior to the First World War is as old as the British commitment not to be tied to France in the event of war. As the Liberal Foreign Secretary Sir Edward Grey wrote in a private letter to the Prime Minister Herbert Asquith on the 16th of April 1911, I quote, "Early in 1906, the French said to us, 'Will you help us if there is a war with Germany?' We said, we can't promise, our hands must be free. The French then urged that the military authorities should be allowed to exchange views. Ours to say what they could do, the French to say how they would like it done, if we did side with France. Otherwise, as the French urged, even if we decided to support France on the outbreak of war, we shouldn't be able to do it effectively. We agreed to this. As late as the 2nd of August 1914, the Prime Minister Asquith was convinced that Britain still had no commitment to France, recording in his diary that, and I quote, "We have no obligation of any kind either to France or Russia to give them military or naval help." This was not the French view. Britain may have wished to have its cake and eat it by drawing the benefits from the Entente with France without accepting the responsibilities implied. I hope you'll forgive me this one anyway, but for the French. But for the French, they wanted the butter and the money for the butter. In seeking to inveigle Britain into a commitment that she was not ready to give. The motivation for France's policy was simple, an almost two-generation fear of Germany. Britain's was far more complex, so that motivation varied according to different factions in government, party, parliament, ministry, and public. There was the historical instinct of not wishing any one state to dominate the continent of Europe, but also the need to placate Russia and France for imperial reasons. The simple French motive for seeking an alliance led her, or her ambassador in London, to push relentlessly for this end. Britain's balancing of complex motives made her reluctant, evasive, and even duplicitous in countering that. In many ways, it was a marriage of convenience, an uneasy entente, and thus likely to give rise to misunderstandings. It is, it seems to me then, helpful to look at what either side hoped to gain from these entente arrangements. What were their ideal objectives? We now know, with hindsight of course, that the Franco-British Entente did become an alliance for the course of the war, and that its contribution was important to the Allies winning that war. The public on both sides of the channel were either never aware of or have forgotten the difficulties that beset the arrangement and the extent to which in August 1914 the Entente came very close to collapse. So what I'd like to do is really, in the brief amount of time that's left, have a look at what each side attempted to gain from the arrangement. And secondly, to have a look at the cross-cultural wires, as I call them, and why there wasn't a meeting of minds between the two sides. So the idealised arrangement. Through sharing similar commitments to democracy, those sharing similar commitments to democracy and the rule of law, and united in a fear of the eventuality of a German-provoked war, Britain and France did not share many other vital strategic interests. But they were willing to put the differences that they had to one side in the interest of their own idea of what the Entente represented to them. That they did not take sufficient cognizance of what the other party desired would become clear with hindsight. So what did each hope to achieve from the Franco-British agreement? And I'll begin with the French requirements from the period of 1905-14, because I see it all as a whole, a sort of block of collaboration. What the French sought most of all from the arrangement were two things. First, protection and security from an increasingly powerful Germany, whose Bismarckian policy had maintained France isolated and vulnerable for 20 years until the Franco-Russian alliance of 1892-4. Second, in the light of her initial security reliance on Russia, France was relieved to have the support of another great power, politically more acceptable to the French public, but also one likely to limit an uneasy dependence on Russia. As an added benefit, the French, like the British, also benefited from the mutual reduction in imperial tensions, which had been a heavy drain on national resources. What did the British hope to get from this Franco-British collaboration during the period from 1905 to 14. The French ambassador in London, Paul Cambon, his wishful thinking led him to believe that what Britain sought from the arrangement with France was an insurance policy against a too powerful Germany, a motive which conveniently dovetailed with the French objective. In other words, he saw Britain's strategy as the traditional one of the balance of power, whereby London was willing to side with any power likely to counterbalance a dominant one on the continent of Europe. For sure, this did motivate British politicians during these years, but it did not do so for all of them all of the time. Moreover, it did not do so for much of the British government during these years, notably the radicals in the cabinet, many of whom preferred to come to an arrangement with Germany, as the Holding Mission of 1912 demonstrated. Furthermore, Cambon did not seem to understand that even if the logic of countering German power on the continent by an arrangement with France was compelling for Britain, he did not allow for the other tenet of British policy, evidenced, as I'll show in a moment, by Palmerston and Gladstone, that Britain should not contract herself to other powers for some future hypothetical scenario. British politicians had, though, other objectives from the Entente. For historians like Keith Wilson, for instance, a powerful lobby in British government and military circles, notably around Sir Edward Grey, wanted the arrangement to act as a stepping stone to the securing of an agreement with Russia on Asia and the maintenance of cordial relations with her to ensure the security of India. According to Keith Wilson, then, if I can quote from him, because Russia was the ally of France, and because Great Britain needed to be on the best possible terms with Russia for her own selfish imperial reasons, the British took advantage of the French connection with Russia to establish a purely imperial one of their own. The Entente was then the opportunity for Britain not to be isolated internationally from the two powers that could do her interests, above all those of the British Empire, much damage, France and Russia. And when British Prime Minister Herbert Asquith was told on the 28th of July 1914 by King George V that he had informed Prince Henry of Prussia that Britain would remain neutral in any conflict, Asquith pointed out to him, Russia says to us, if you won't say you are ready to side with us now, your friendship is valueless, and we shall act on that assumption in the future. Shortly afterwards, the French ambassador in London, Paul Cambon, warned that in those last days before war, that if those in France who counted on British assistance were let down, I quote, those in favour of an alliance with Germany at the expense of Britain could feel justified. And Cambon went on to say that France would look on at the ruin of the British Empire, and I quote, without a movement of sympathy. At stake then for Britain was loss of the British Empire and more. As Sir Arthur Nicholson put it, and I quote at length what he said, it is difficult not to agree with Mr. Sazonov that sooner or later England will be dragged into the war if it comes. Should that war come and England stands aside, one of two things must happen. A, either Germany and Austria win, crush France and humiliate Russia. With the French fleet gone, Germany in occupation of the Channel, with the willing or willing cooperation of Holland and Belgium, what will be the position of a friendless England? B, or France and Russia win, what would then be their attitude towards England? What about India and the Mediterranean? The French should have suspected that something was up in the way their views of the Entente and those of the British were not aligned. That astute observer of Franco-British relations, Geneviève Tabouille, put her finger on the problem, noting, and I quote, from the very moment of signature, the Foreign Office sought to minimise the extent of the Entente, while the Quai d'Orsay took pains to make the very most of it. The French also failed to detect anything untoward in the secretiveness with which the British surrounded the Franco-British military and naval talks, which were never known by more than four ministers at any one time before the autumn of 1911, and never espoused by more than five ministers out of 20 at any one time thereafter. Britain, on the other hand, though, as Churchill reminded Grey, had all the duties of an alliance and none of the advantages. Critics have suggested that absence of a formal alliance denied Britain the opportunity of restraining French diplomacy and French decision makers, while at the same time failing to deter Berlin about British interests. Thus, on either side, cultural misunderstandings created on the part of the French an expectation of support, and on the part of the British a moral commitment into which they had been gradually lured. Because the outcome of the whole episode was eventually a success, in that France and Britain did become allies for the war's duration and were victorious, there has been a tendency in France and Britain subsequently to overlook how the relationship could have gone startlingly wrong. Britain could have decided at the end to stay neutral, leaving France to confront Germany alone. Of course, historians like Neil Ferguson, ironically taking the side of the cabinet radicals opposed to Britain siding with France or going to war, have claimed that Britain would have been much better off remaining neutral. But this is to ignore, I think, as Sir Arthur Nicholson put it above, what the consequences of such a policy would have been for Britain in the aftermath of war. So how might the difficulties inherent in that Franco-British Entente be explained? And I'm not going to go into all the details, of course, of which I do in the paper, of the development of the Franco-British staff talks and the sort of crossed cultural wires that are evidenced in that, nor am I going to go into the details of the Grey-Cambon exchange of letters in November 1912, in which there is a clear sign of cultural crosswires. But what I'd like to do now, very briefly, is have a look at those cultural crosswires in some general ways. There were several, it seems to me, several levels of potential misunderstanding between Paris and London over the nature and purpose of the Entente that ranged from different cultural identities and approaches to more down-to-earth differences between individuals, and in particular between Sir Edward Grey and the French ambassador in London, Paul Cambon. So something about the difference between peoples, if I can talk in those rather broad terms. And I'll begin with this quotation. That the British are pragmatic, empirical, and practical. The French juridical, deductive, and systematic. That the British are what they like to call outward-looking, where the French are continental, are platitudes that have all at one time or another helped to explain as well as to complicate the uneasy Franco-British relationship so ill-named Entente Cordiale. A clear Freudian slip there. Yet when issues are actually in dispute, the importance of these and other recognised incompatibilities in the field of foreign policy is often underestimated, as is the importance of the cumulative effect of a long history of misunderstandings. So wrote the authority on France in the post-war years, Dorothy Pickles, outlining the different intellectual and cultural approaches to foreign policy making between the two countries. And she went on to say that, I quote, one of the most important factors in Franco-British misunderstanding is the British preference for cautious empiricism and dislike of specific commitments in fields of general principle, above all, of fixed resolutions for eventual probabilities. Of course, Dorothy Pickles was not alone in this view. The British Prime Minister William Gladstone explained this trait of British diplomacy in more detail in a letter to Queen Victoria on the 17th of April 1869. England should keep entire in her own hands the means of estimating her own obligations upon the various states of facts as they arise. She should not foreclose and narrow her own liberty of choice by declarations made to other powers in their real or supposed interests, of which they would claim to be at least joint interpreters. It is dangerous for her to assume alone an advanced and therefore isolated position in regard to European controversies. Come what may, it is better for her to promise too little than too much. The differing cultural practices were further outlined by Pickles in noting that, and I quote, French governments, with their Cartesian preferences for precision and for progression from the general to the particular, have fought for precise statements of principle and for commitments and guarantees with a passion and a consistency comprehensible only in the context both of their political insecurity and of their juridical and systematic approach to international relations. Had British politicians and officials understood more clearly France's overwhelming need for an alliance with Britain and France's juridical way of proceeding, Britain might not have been so naively seduced into a perceived moral commitment by July 1914. Similarly, a better understanding of Britain's position and ways of proceeding might have clarified their respective positions and reduced mutual confusion about the issue of commitment. As Harold Nicholson noted on French diplomacy, I quote, the concentration again of the French mind upon a particular line of policy prevents them on occasions from observing events which lie outside their immediate and intense focus. This is a reflection, it seems to me, of Paul Cambon's weakness. Consumed by an intense concentration on achieving an alliance, he often did not see the wood for the trees. And now something about the personalities involved in this. Other than the general national cultural framework seen to be governing approaches to foreign policy in the two states, there was also the difference in the intellectual framework of individuals involved in the policy-making process. The diplomat Harold Nicholson described in particular the faults of British statesmen in the early part of the 20th century. I quote, there is considerable ignorance, not so much of foreign conditions as of foreign psychology. There is unbound optimism. There is a dislike of facing unpleasant possibilities in advance. The classic example, it seems to me, of this was the British Foreign Secretary, Sir Edward Grey. His direct experience of foreign countries was extremely limited, never having set foot in France until, if I remember correctly, April 1914, and speaking no foreign languages. In many ways, he conformed to Prince Bülow's impressions of the English politician recorded in his diary during a visit to Windsor. I quote, the English politicians do not know the continent well. They do not know much about conditions on the continent than we know about conditions in Peru or Siam. Their general ideas, according to our standard, are somewhat naive. There is something naive in their unconscious egotism, but they have also a certain credulity. They are not prone to suspect really evil intentions. They are very quiet, rather indolent, and very optimistic. Just as Grey might be characterised as the archetypal English politician, according to those definitions, Paul Cambon had many of the traits of the archetypal Frenchman. He was convinced of the superiority of French culture, maybe the case, and was more at home in Paris than abroad. Indeed, for all of its longevity from 1898 to 1920, Paul Cambon did not enjoy his posting to London, although he drew considerable satisfaction from his achievements there. This in itself became part of the problem, it seems. Thinking as he did of himself as the instigator and the guarantor of the Entente, he became complacent about its strengths and blinded to its weaknesses. He never came to terms with the climate, spoke insufficient English, socialised little, and consequently spent almost one weekend in two back in Paris, as his own son recorded in his memoirs. This may also explain why he came to rely too heavily on the views and opinions of the permanent Undersecretary of State at the Foreign Office, Sir Arthur Nicholson, with whom he had entertained good relations since their posting to Constantinople. He wrongly supposed then that Nicholson was the voice of Grey and the British government, but Nicholson was a persistent advocate of closer ties to France and Russia, and certainly did not represent the increasingly powerful views of the more pro-German Foreign Office grouping around people such as Sir William Tyrrell, Grey's private secretary. Consequently, Cambon did not have the full picture of interests competing for Grey's attention, not all of whom were so enthusiastic about closer relations with France. Nor was Franco-British mutual understanding fostered by the fact that, according to Paul Cambon's son, during diplomatic audiences, Grey spoke English and Cambon French, both paying attention to articulate clearly. If, as Henri Cambon noted in respect of Grey, many nuances must have escaped him, then it would be fair to deduce that many must have escaped Paul Cambon too. For a diplomat, albeit not by training, as he had come to the career via the French prefectoral corps rather than the Quai d'Orsay, Paul Cambon did appear to underestimate a key concept of British constitutional practice, the role of collective cabinet government in British policy and decision making. For that reason, he underestimated the significance of cabinet opposition to war and the role of Parliament in the final decision in 1914. That acute observer then of French and British diplomatic practices, Harold Nicholson, quoted in this respect what the Foreign Secretary Lord Palmerston wrote to the British ambassador in Russia, I quote, "It is not usual for England to enter into engagements with reference to cases which have not actually arisen or which are not immediately in prospect. And this for a plain reason. All formal engagements of the Crown, which involve the questions of peace and war, must be submitted to Parliament, and Parliament might probably not approve of an engagement which should bind England prospectively to take up arms in a contingency which could not as yet be foreseen." So, in conclusion, obviously, I'm not going to go into the genesis of all of that related to the period from 1906 to 1914 and the staff talks and then subsequently the Grey-Cambon exchange of letters. But if I could end up with a few words of conclusion about how this arrangement of Franco-British relations from 1905-6 to 1914 has been remembered. A combination, it seems to me, of lack of candour about the nature of the Franco-British relationship, the absence of a certain cultural awareness, the presence of personalities with differing mental maps conspired to produce, over several years, a Franco-British dialogue of the deaf that could have had serious consequences for either country in 1914. Although not for the war's duration, it did have consequences after the war in the 1920s in how the process of military staff talks, naval arrangements, and Franco-British relations were remembered. Both sides interpreted the experience differently. For some British politicians, officials, and members of the public, particularly those seduced by the arguments of the 1920s, fueled in part by German propaganda, that France and Raymond Poincaré had an important share of responsibility in the origins of the war, negative lessons were learnt of the pre-war relationship with France. Many in the 1920s were convinced that before war, London had become committed to Paris and had rejected better relations with Berlin as a result of what Samuel Williamson has called a policy of stealth and subterfuge, partly at the hand of France. Consequently, in the 1920s, British politicians were extremely wary of striking up a new agreement with Paris, let alone an alliance with her, in order to allow London greater freedom, in part to develop better relations with Weimar Germany, and not become embroiled in what some saw as a new French bid for hegemony in Europe. Similarly, in the 1930s, following Hitler's reoccupation of the Rhineland, British proposals for Anglo-French-Belgian open military staff talks provoked hostility amongst military planners who believed the 1905 Franco-British conversations had restricted the options for the British Expeditionary Force in 1914. In 1920s France, the pre-war experience of British hesitancy led politicians and diplomats to press all the more strongly for a formal alliance. The fact that the decade-long relationship had culminated in the alliance and the joint war effort put a far more positive glow on renewing the alliance because it demonstrated what could be achieved by it. Thus, in retrospect, the Entente Cordiale became the starting point for an ever closer union with Britain and the reference point for future improved relations with London. Brushing aside what might have come to pass if Britain had not finally come down on France's side, French politicians and the public concentrated on the victorious outcome. Clemenceau was willing to make serious sacrifices in order to achieve that, as the stillborn 1920 alliance with the US and Britain demonstrated. Even then, throughout the rest of the 1920s, the French were again at serious pains to convince London of the necessity of renewing the alliance and were still hankering for one until war came in 1939. Refreshed by the positive elements of Franco-British wartime cooperation, the Entente Cordiale emerged more appealing still in Paris after 1945 and would remain so until the unfortunate experience of Suez in 1956 led the French to take the European route rather than one of dependence on Britain or association with Britain. But when it came to the centennial celebrations of the Entente Cordiale in 2004, little of the difficult experience of that decade, 1904-14, clouded the French memory. As the French Foreign Minister Dominique de Villepin noted in the foreword to a volume celebrating that centenary, I quote, "The great revolution that the Entente began was to ensure that our century of shared diplomacy has been marked by only friendly disagreements." How different the picture might have looked had it not been for Belgium in August 1914.
Well, in this fascinating paper, John Keogh reflects on the misunderstandings that bedeviled the Anglo-French Entente on the eve of war in 1914. And in accounting for these malentendus, he directs his attention above all to two things: culture and divergent interests. The cultural history of international relations remains a field in its infancy, but I think that John's paper and John's remarks do illustrate the strength and promise of such an approach. It's hard to think of two individuals who personified more absolutely the contrast between French and British approaches to political communication and international relations than Sir Edward Grey and Paul Cambon. Like many of the great French ambassadors of the old school, Cambon didn't merely represent France, he was France. This was a man, after all, who argued against the foundation in London of a lycée for the children of French functionaries abroad on the grounds that Frenchmen educated in Britain tended to emerge from the experience mentally retarded. His was a Frenchness so intent that it required almost fortnightly replenishments in Paris, where he could escape the fogs of London and the rigours of British cuisine. As for Grey, the one-time real tennis champion, who took a third in jurisprudence at Oxford, a subject he chose because it was deemed to be, or thought to be easy, Grey embodied, or perhaps performed would be a better word, a kind of diffident dilettantism that bore the imprint of a highly specific English social milieu. This was a foreign secretary who was profoundly incurious about all places that were not England, who disliked the company of foreigners, and who never learned French, as John pointed out. He did not visit France until April 1914. That is an extraordinary fact, but it is a true one. The performed quality of Grey's statesmanly persona should not be overlooked. This was a man who intrigued his way into power and then intrigued virtually continuously in order to hold on to it, and yet who always claimed to find politics a ghastly and unedifying burden and an interruption from the bird-watching, rambling, and fly-fishing that were the true content of his life. One can readily imagine the exasperation of the officials in their crowded offices at the FO as the Foreign Secretary slipped off after lunch on a Friday for yet another long country weekend. It's hard to dissent from Cecil Spring Rice's judgment of 1913 to the effect that, and I quote, "It would be good if our foreign," I'm quoting this incidentally from Zara's book, "it would be good if our foreign secretary might spare his ducks and spend a little more time on his French." So it makes sense, I think, to seek to anchor the misunderstandings that troubled Anglo-French relations in cultural contrasts. John focuses in particular on a French preference for textuality, which he contrasts with a British preference for pragmatic, flexible, non-binding and non-written arrangements. And there's a certain irony here, because Paul Cambon saw in the president of the French Republic, Raymond Poincaré, precisely the rigid contractuality of a man of law. It was to this that Paul Cambon ascribed Poincaré's eagerness to solidify France's support for Russian policy in the Balkans. In Poincaré's undertakings vis-à-vis St. Petersburg, Cambon saw a stiffness, raideur, and literal mindedness that risked tying France's hands in the East. In the Grey Cambon duet, by contrast, it was Cambon who was looking for literality and solid commitments. So there's a certain irony there if we think about this relationship in its broader context. Another interesting point that John makes relates to what I would call the polyvocality, the chorus-like quality of the foreign policy-making process in pre-war Europe. Grey was probably one of the most powerful foreign ministers in Europe, alongside Bethmann Hollweg, who of course was both Chancellor and Prussian Foreign Minister. Among other things, he had been in office for 8 years by the time war broke out. During his pre-war tenure in office, and I'm sure I've got this wrong, I think, if I remember, my count is correct, 16, no fewer than 16 French foreign ministers had come and gone. Two of them, I think, had come and gone twice. But anyway, it's a much larger number than one, let's put it that way. yet, I didn't have time to go and check the exact number, but there's an amazing sort of revolving door, as you all know, bringing people in and out of this office. Yet Grey's capacity to shape policy outcomes was anything but secure. British policy spoke with many voices, and this goes some of the way to explaining the extraordinary acrobatics he was obliged to perform in order to shield his policy from the prying eyes of the public, the Parliament, the Liberal Party, and even his own cabinet. These extravagant manoeuvres may help to explain, incidentally, why Cambon, to use John's words, underestimated the role of collective cabinet government in British policy and decision-making. Because Cambon's chief experience in London, after all, was of a British policy made virtually everywhere but in cabinet. Paris, too, was a kitchen in which too many cooks often spoiled the broth. Think of the remarkable multi-tiered skirmishing during and after the Agadir crisis between Premier Joseph Caillou, an exponent, of course, of rapprochement with Germany, the hawkish Maurice Herbet at the Quai d'Orsay, one of the members of the renowned Centrale, Jules Cambon in Berlin, two ineffectual foreign ministers, Kruppi and de Selve, a range of radical politicians, and various other intermediaries. This was a battle fought with the dirtiest weapons, including stolen letters, burgled decrypts, and leaked intercepts. We shouldn't forget how close Poincaré came to buying off Clemenceau in 1913 by throwing him Cambon's job in London, to the horror, of course, of the Frères Cambon. So both the protagonists, in John's account, were operating within highly conflicted environments, characterized by quite unstable power relations. John makes a further important point. For France, the Entente had always been about containing Germany. But, and this is something recent work by Keith Nielsen, Keith Wilson, and Thomas Otte, but it's also a very central theme of the older work by Zahra Steiner, who's here with us today, has made increasingly clear, Germany was not at the center of the calculations that brought Britain into the Entente, which should be seen rather as the next step, and John hinted at this, after the Japanese alliance of 1902, in a sequence of steps designed to contain the threat posed by Russia. The last of these steps was, of course, the Convention of 1908. The Anglo-French relationship was not the only one troubled by such crossed purposes. The same point can be made about the Franco-Russian alliance. It was a fact universally understood in St. Petersburg and in Paris that Russia would no more risk its arm for Alsace and Lorraine than France would chance its arms for Russian access to the Turkish Straits. And in St. Petersburg, too, foreign policy was not a single coherent program or standpoint, but rather a chorus of dissonant voices, not all of which expounded the view that the German threat outweighed the British one. And there were disagreements, of course, as well in St. Petersburg about how one should balance the imperatives implicit in the Franco-Russian alliance with Russian interest in securing control of the Turkish Straits, two objectives which were not easily reconcilable given the immense French financial interests in the Ottoman Empire. It was precisely in order to bring some clarity to this tangled state of affairs that Poincaré pushed his interlocutors in St. Petersburg towards clearer and more binding statements of the mutual commitments underpinning the alliance. So should we blame Cambon for his trustful attitude towards the British, and towards Grey in particular? There are a few mauvais quarts d'heure, to be sure. But Cambon was right, surely, in the longer run, and the run was only a few days long after all. In the crisis situation of the first days of August 1914, emotions were running high, and one can readily understand why. The fear of abandonment for Cambon, and the fear for Grey of being sucked in out of his depth before there had been time to secure support for his policy, produced a heightening and polarization of utterance that may lead us to misread the underlying realities of the situation. And there are a few observations that one could make in this connection, but I don't want to take longer than my brief allotted time, so let me conclude just by making two very, very brief points. The first is that it seems to me, and again this is something John touches on in his paper, in the written version of the paper, it seems to me the French were actually quite clear about the possibility that Britain wouldn't necessarily enter into this war straight away. Joffre, as we know, was the first French strategist to integrate the BEF into his planning, but he did not assume that one could count on the British in the first hour of the conflict. And internal discussions within the Franco-Russian alliance made it clear over and over again that one could count on the British in the longer run because British interests would dictate intervention, but one couldn't necessarily assume a sort of first-hour intervention. So that's the first point. The second relates to the fact that French policy in the summer of 1914 placed Britain before what we could call a fait accompli. We need to remember the complex ways in which the Anglo-French Entente had to respond to the commitments embodied in the Franco-Russian alliance. This is an immensely complex problem, and the more one tries to think it through and understand it, the more difficult it gets, I can tell you. In the course of talks conducted during 1912 and 1913, Poincaré and various other diplomats and military officials had extended this commitment to cover the eventuality of a Balkan conflict in which Russia might feel obliged to take the initiative against Austria. And precisely this scenario became reality in 1914, when the key policymakers of the Franco-Russian alliance opted to recognize in the quarrel unfolding between Belgrade and Vienna a casus fideris, a matter triggering the alliance. And there was one hairy moment when it looked as if the alliance with Russia might indeed undermine the moral tie with Britain. On the 1st of August 1914, Grey wrote to Barty that Germany had, in France, the ambassador in France, that Germany had agreed not to attack France if France remained neutral. He added ominously, if France could not take advantage of this offer, it was because she was bound by an alliance, and I'm quoting, to which we are not parties and of which we do not know the terms. So this is the situation that faced the British decision makers in the last days of July, the first days of August 1914. Now, as we now know, this argument was offered for highly specific tactical reasons. And as we also know, it never became the animating logic of British policy. The British did not insist, look, this is your alliance, you've made this deal with Russia, you get on with it. That did not end up being the trumping argument. And that's because, although there certainly was an element of fait accompli in the situation facing the Entente, or the British half of the Entente in 1914, this was a fait accompli that Grey was fundamentally happy to accept. Already in December 1912, he had issued a warning to the Germans that traced out exactly the scenario of 1914. There would be a quarrel in the Balkans. It didn't really matter. Grey makes this explicit in a later conversation with Cambon, but he makes it explicit in other conversations as well. It didn't really matter who started it. He wasn't particularly interested in who was the provocateur, though he said it would be preferable if Austria looked as if it were in the wrong. Russia would pile in, bringing in Germany in defense of Austria. France would, as he put it, inevitably intervene on the side of her ally. And in that situation, Grey warned the Germans, Britain would not stand aside and watch France be crushed by Germany. This is his warning to the Germans, but it's repeated more or less verbatim with a few interesting variations in communications with Cambon. And this is precisely the script that Grey followed in 1914. He did not inspect or weigh up the Austrian case against Serbia. Indeed, he showed no interest in it whatsoever, not because he believed the Serbian government was innocent of the charges against it. On the contrary, he believed that they were not. But because he acquiesced in the Franco-Russian view that the Austrian threat to Serbia constituted a pretext, that was Herr Kroh's word, incidentally, it constituted a pretext for activating the alliance. Grey was genuinely horrified at the prospect of war, and his hand-wringing in August 1914 was absolutely genuine. but it never occurred to him that the best way to avert war might have been to halt Russian military preparations. Instead, he focused, like Poincaré, on Germany as the power in whose hands supposedly rested the choice between peace and war. In other words, Grey's reading and handling of the European crisis was anything but neutral. It was ententiste to a fault, and this belied the diffident, standoffish posture he adopted in his conversations with Cambon. Grey knew that French expectations ran ahead of British undertakings, but this didn't especially worry him, because he also understood that Britain would eventually fall in behind the Entente powers, not as a matter of obligation, but as a matter of policy. Thank you.